Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share my recent conversation with True Overholt. True is a graduate from our Executive MBA class of 2018. And if you're interested in learning more about our Executive MBA program, the impact of the program, the GEMBA format, I would say this episode is essential listening. Truly one of my favorite podcasts we've recorded in this 2022 year. So without further ado, here's my interview with True Overholt. True, welcome to the podcast.
Wonderful. Thank you for inviting me and having me on, Brett.
Well, I'll share this as a starting point for our conversation. As the person who gets to host these podcasts, occasionally I'll be sitting at my desk and say, I wonder what's up with this person, what they're doing. And I just invite them on the podcast. That's my way of catching up and seeing what you've been up to. I would say you were somebody that, like, I can't say that I had ever met anybody that did the work that you were doing when you were applying to Darden. I was so fascinated by it and knew a little bit about your story post-Darden, but I'm so excited, like our listeners, to learn more. But first and foremost, how are you doing right now?
Good. As I shared a little bit earlier, I just had a newborn, or I have a newborn son who's a month old today. And so we are relearning sleep schedules and becoming experts at putting on diapers in the dark. And the one thing I didn't know, maybe my parents had told me, is that, like, when you're changing the diaper, that's the moment where he pees. Right. So, like, we have like a pee blocker that we put in front of him while, so it's like a one-handed diaper fixing and then pee blocking and all this stuff. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And we're enjoying it so far. And, you know, it kind of puts everything in perspective as to what's important and what gives you joy and things like that.
And how's everybody doing? How's mom? Good. Okay?
Yeah. Everything went okay. Mom is doing well. She's up and around and walking. And, you know, we also have a dog who's about a year and a half old. So not a puppy still, but full of energy. And so it's like, we'll try and go for a walk and have like the stroller and the dog and then, like, you know, a cup of coffee. And you just wish you had like eight hands all at the same time.
I think that's when you know you have to get a personal assistant.
Right. Yeah, exactly. A little bit more help around. But we're lucky we have family in the area. And so it's been really nice having extra hands, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, it's everything to help contribute that way.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. I'm glad to hear everyone at home is doing well. And so appreciative of your coming on the podcast to share more of your story. We kind of start with the same first question here. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about your background. Who are you? What do you do? And what did you do before coming to Darden?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is True Overholt. I work for DKT International, which is a social enterprise. And so I've been working for DKT for about 10 years now. So both before I enrolled at Darden as well as after. And so in the parlance of Darden, I would be a climber, I guess, not a switcher or some of the other categories. We can get into that more later. And so DKT is a social enterprise. And what we do is we're an NGO. We're a 501c3 nonprofit registered in the United States, but we're global. We have offices in about 28, 29 countries around the world now. And we have kind of our operations extend to about 65 countries around the world. And what we do is we use kind of business tactics to promote sexual and reproductive health products. And so we use the private sector, the public sector, the existing supply chains. We use demand generation tactics and techniques like marketing and advertising and training and promotion to do everything we can basically to help men and women use family planning products so that they can have the number of kids that they want to have.
I imagine many of our listeners are wondering how you got involved with this work in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a happy coincidence. When I was doing my undergrad studies, so I grew up taking French classes. Actually, I went to a French immersion public elementary school, and I kept up doing French after that. And so when I was in undergrad, they had two. It was a fairly small liberal arts school, and they had two French study abroad options. And one was like to Paris in the spring, which sounds lovely. And then the second one was to Mali in the winter. I went to school in Minnesota, so I was pretty eager to like not be there during the winter. And I also thought to myself, like, when am I ever going to go to Mali on my own? Like, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And I can go to Paris on my own, you know, later on in life. And so I went on this 4-month program, roughly, and that kind of jump-started my interest in international development. And so I knew that I wanted to do work that involved the developing world, and I didn't really know what it would be yet. And I was lucky enough to meet the guy who's now the president of DKT. And, you know, he started kind of talking to me about this idea of social marketing, of using kind of business tactics, business techniques to achieve social ends. And I became really intrigued, and it kind of just snowballed from there. And that was 10 years ago.
And is that novel for an organization, a nonprofit organization, to take those kind of business tactics and deploy them in service of something like reproductive health?
Yeah, it is. I think certainly, you know, there's a few organizations in our field, but they're like the degree of subsidy or the degree of like kind of donor money that they need to exist is pretty skewed. And we actually run these numbers a lot. So DKT, my organization, about 70% of our annual budget is paid for by sales of the products that we make and sell. And then that other 30% is coming from international donors like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or other, you know, other donors. Our nearest competitor, their revenue of sales is about 5%. And so they're entirely reliant, you know, 95% of their work is reliant on donors, which is, you know, that's not a criticism at all, but it does then make you reliant on those donors. And it has some kinds of effects where, you know, in the COVID pandemic, we saw a massive contraction of donor budgets as a lot of Western governments had to focus on delivering healthcare at home. And so that means that those organizations had to downsize their operations. It also means that what programs tend to focus on is what the donor wants and not necessarily what the people in that country need. And so, you know, when you have your own financial resources, it gives you a lot of freedom and liberty to kind of focus on what matters in that context. So it's a unique business model, but it's one that that has served us well so far. And, you know, we're always trying to strike that balance of how do we make products affordable? Because that's also part of our mission. And then, you know, at the same time, how do we keep sustaining our programs through whatever kind of cross-subsidization or revenue generation that we can? Because at the end of the day, if we run out of money, then we can't do anybody any good at all. So it's constantly striving to keep that balance between those two objectives.
So where did you start when you took you said, okay, DKT, I like what you're doing. I like this approach. And what was your first role there?
So I was actually an intern. I started as an intern when I was 21 or 22. And I worked there, the headquarters in Washington, D.C. And it's, you know, for an organization that's about a, you know, they have probably a $250 million like annual budget per year. And yet the headquarters has maybe 10 people. So it's like a very modest headquarters in D.C., because, you know, all of our programming happens in the field. And that's kind of what been one of the philosophies is that, you know, if we're trying to serve the people of Egypt or of Ghana or of, you know, Mozambique or wherever, then the people who are making the decisions about that program should be there, right? You should be in that context, in that country. You should be understanding what matters to the folks that you're trying to serve. And so, you know, we have about 5,000 employees globally, and only 10 of them are in the headquarters in the US. All the rest of them are in the field. So I started there kind of doing, you know, some of the intern stuff, learning what I could. And then I had the opportunity to apply for a position in Ghana. And so I went, I moved to Ghana, and I worked in our Ghana office for about 2 years before coming back to the United States. And that was about, you know, being in Ghana was kind of what showed me that I needed to further my education. You know, I needed to kind of enrich myself and to be able to provide more value and to be able to kind of offer more to these kinds of programs. And so that's when I came back to the US, I was fortunate enough to continue working with DKT in the headquarters, but that was kind of when I knew I wanted to go back to grad school in some form.
What was it about that Ghanaian experience that led you to say, you know what, I really do need more education. Like, what's the nature of the project you were working on there? And did you have a moment where it just like crystallized for you?
Yeah, so I was there in a project coordinator, project manager role. And the specific project that I was working on was, how do we convince young Ghanaians to start using these products? And so it touches on kind of like a lot of really complicated, messy topics, right? There's certainly taboos about communicating sex education, things like that to young people, to 14, 15, 16, 18-year-olds, whatever. There's certainly, and Ghana has a, what I would characterize as a fairly conservative traditional culture. And so any kind of discussion around sexuality outside of marriage is a difficult conversation to have, you know, no matter what. And then you're talking on kind of the religious aspect of that. And so that's kind of where I was coming from and where I was starting. And then looking in Ghana, like there's also a public health aspect of what we're looking at is, you know, when a young person, you know, when a 17-year-old woman has an unplanned pregnancy, and that like that derails a significant part of her life, right? That's different than a 35-year-old woman who maybe already has two kids having an unplanned pregnancy. And so there's kind of, you know, we're talking about the same event, but there's different levels of impact that those outcomes have. And so I was kind of looking at these things, and so for a while I was actually thinking of going towards like a master's of public health, an MPH route, because that fit into what I was seeing. And but then it struck me that like I was learning a lot about that just by being there, right? Being in the context, I was picking up a lot of kind of the communication campaigns, right? Looking at what are the gaps in knowledge and understanding that people have, and seeing how can we bridge those gaps and how can we communicate that. And the education that I absolutely did not have was around like marketing, sales, distribution, running a business, accounting, any of the things. And it kind of, you know, as I was growing within the company and as I was taking on more roles, I kept coming up against business problems. And like the communication stuff, like, you know, the way to think about these products, like kind of the marketing, that I kind of had an intuition for, but there are some of these issues around, you know, buying and selling and wholesale pricing and all these different things that like I couldn't get this education just by learning in the company, or I felt that there was a gap, right? There was kind of like a glass ceiling to what I could learn there. And that's what kind of signaled that I should look at going to school, to, you know, getting a formal education to help kind of bridge some of that information.
Was it a common thing for people in your organization to go get an MBA? I wonder, given that your nonprofit has that business kind of approach, is that something that people do, or is it still a pretty singular thing?
I would say, so within my sector, it is uncommon, right? Within like the international development, you know, sphere, it's pretty uncommon. Within DKT, within my company, it's more common. And that's actually by design, right? That's the kind of person that we recruit, that we look for. And so I have colleagues who come from all kinds of different fast-moving consumer goods companies, right? People who've worked at L'Oreal, at Coca-Cola, at Novartis, at Abbott, at, you know, anybody who's kind of in this medical healthcare, medical devices, pharma, that sphere. Those are the kinds of folks who tend to do well in an organization like DKT, because they get the basics. They have a good understanding of what kind of structures, you know, what's the infrastructure that we need to put in place to actually help get these products out to people. And when you think about, you know, selling a stick of gum and selling a condom, like sometimes those go through the same distribution channels. And so if you know how to do one, you can kind of intuit the basics of how to do the other. And so that kind of describes the kinds of folks that we have. But then, you know, we also try and seek out people from the developing world, or who have experience in the developing world, because, you know, somebody who has an MBA and has worked in in the American context may kind of be thrown for a loop when they set 2 feet down in Ghana and don't really have an understanding of how it works there. So that was part of what actually attracted me to the Darden program, was the Gemba. I don't know if it's still called that, but like the Gemba program, you know, having that global shade or that global influence in the education was something that I found really appealing.
Yeah, we still have a global executive MBA format. It's still around. And one of the things true that has developed over the past few years is we now have, COVID willing, we have up to 12 global residency locations typically offered. I know, it's pretty cool, right? Travel has been, so right around the time we announced all of this in the fall of 2019, and we were so excited that we were going to have students go to all these locations. I mean, we have countries all across the major continents, the world, and I mean, ranging from like Chile, all the way to Japan, Australia, Morocco, the list kind of goes on and on. And obviously it's different from class to class, but now we previously had just 4 global residency locations for students to choose from. Now we have a menu of 12 that people can choose from. And, you know, that is, I will say, typical experience for most executive format students. Once they travel once, they want to travel more. And as we always say, if you think you want to travel more than once, you really should be a Gimba format student. Yeah. Just go all 4. You're going to want to do it anyhow. Talk to us just a little bit more about your interest in Darden. How did Darden land on your radar, and what led you to say, gosh, this is the school for me?
Sure. So I mean, first was that, I think that like the first thing that really sets it apart is that I knew I wanted to keep working. And so I knew that I wanted a format where I could continue in my job, where I wouldn't have to give up my job. And so that kind of already narrowed down the opportunities. And I knew that I wanted something in the DC area. So that narrowed it a bit further. So, you know, when it really came down to it, I was looking at 3-4 schools probably. And then from there, what really kind of intrigued me about Darden, I'd say that, of course, there's the reputation. You know, you look at rankings, you look at things like that. But the ranking that I actually paid the most attention to is quality of teaching. And that's something my undergrad education, they had very good quality of teaching. And so I started to get a taste for like, what does that actually mean? Because it can be kind of hard to describe what a quality teacher is, unless you've seen it, unless you've actually sampled it. And I think that was something where I saw that and I was like, okay, this is a place that I want to learn more about and look into. And then when we were, I think I was either speaking with you or Sarah or somebody else in the admissions department, and I was like learning more, I was like, am I too young to be in the executive program? Right? Like, I didn't really want to make that sacrifice of having to go for a full-time program. And I think, you know, one of you just encouraged me to apply anyway. And then seeing that Gemba format, that was kind of the deal maker for me, where I was like, wow, this looks really cool. You know, my work takes me to some of these places, but it would be even more advantageous to go back to China or India or any of these. You know, in my program, even we were supposed to go to Brazil. And then, you know, this was like 4 global catastrophes ago. It was the Zika virus where we had to switch, and we went to South Africa instead. But it was an incredible experience all around. And, you know, it was really fortunate because that's a place that I hadn't necessarily had the chance to go. And just to see, you know, more about the African economy in that country was really interesting. So I think those were the things that really kind of put Darden on the map for me. And then I had the chance to see the new space as it was developing in Arlington, right? Yeah. In Roslyn. And I was intrigued, and so I was very happy to apply at that point.
Yeah, well, now we have even more options for folks who want to continue working while pursuing their MBA. We now have a part-time MBA program. We're recruiting for the inaugural cohort. Well, as we speak, so to say, here, first cohort starts in August. And so first week of school, true, one of the things that's really, really cool, I was actually mentioning this to some students who were here on a tour on Monday night in August of 2022. For the first time in the history of the school, we'll have all the residential full-time MBA students on grounds for their opening week. We'll have all the executive MBA class of 2024 students there. And we're also going to have the part-time MBA cohort in Charlottesville on the same week. It's going to be a great week.
That's tremendous. Yeah, that's really impressive.
Well, let's talk about your experience as a Gemba student, because you mentioned you went to South Africa. You also spent some time in Western Europe, I believe France and Germany.
Berlin. Yeah.
Yeah. And then India and China. How did those experiences, traveling abroad, being in those places, how did that affect, impact, contribute to your MBA?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I mean, there's the, let's say the downside is you have to prepare for a full week of classes all at once. but, you know, the quality of those experiences and really, you know, there's the classwork, which of course is important. And the professors did a very nice job of kind of tailoring the content or the subject matter to the environment. And so, right, like we did a Chinese accounting class when we were in China, or it's like an accounting class, but about these Chinese SPACs. You know, this was before SPACs were like a buzzword, right? We were learning about this happening in like the early 2000s. When we were in India, you know, we're learning like an operations and manufacturing class, you know, and India is a big manufacturing hub. And so there's a really nice kind of, like they dovetailed the content in a nice way, which was useful to kind of bring some of that alive. But more than that were the speakers, right? The guest speakers that come in and you get to hear from folks who are leading businesses. I mean, we did in South Africa, we met with the chief economist of the Fed, right? Like the Reserve Bank of South Africa. This guy is so incredibly smart. And like, you know, at this point we're going through our econ classes and like talking about inflation and stuff like that. And here's a guy who like, he's the guy who fights it in that country, right? Like he's the one who kind of is the governor of the Fed. And so just these incredible conversations to really bring alive these different experiences we had. And, you know, when I think back on my education at Darden, you know, and maybe this is just how my mind works, but like, I just have like little snippets of memories, right? Things like a quip that a teacher makes in a class, or, you know, something, a point that was punctuated, or, you know, one of these conversations that we had with these incredible speakers. And so like, in terms of how much did I retain, I think I retained a lot more because of, right, like these, you have these in-person emotional, right, there's something visceral about being there with these different speakers, people who work for Tata or people who are working in, one of the speakers in China was like a biomedical investor, kind of like the Chinese venture funds where they go out and buy these products and then commercialize them in China. And so there were tons and tons and tons of really interesting, really cool experiences like that. I think for me, you know, in terms of how I've applied that to my working life, is just having a little bit more of this comfort, of this kind of aptitude internationally, right? You, when you're traveling abroad and you're kind of learning, you're seeing a little bit of how business etiquette is done through Darden. It's kind of a safe way to learn. So that when you go out and you're meeting a customer, a supplier, somebody on your own, like you've had the chance to do a test run in a safe environment, and so you feel a little bit more confident when you're approaching these people in a global context.
And now it's worth noting the global residencies, they take place between quarters, so it's all about company visits. It's all about speakers. Yeah, you don't have to worry about preparing for a whole week of class. you're just there, and you're there with the goal of really kind of developing and understanding what business looks like. And as Lottie Carr would say, if she's here, the framework for the global residencies recently is to kind of take a look at some businesses doing business in the country. And then kind of like basically with the country and then for the country, like on behalf of the country, and kind of this kind of like framework. And you know, we'll see where things go. I think the great thing about the global residency is it's kind of like this, it's a bit of a blank slate. You can try different things. You could do different things, but you so correctly note that the experiences that you're having when you travel are not things you can just plug into as a tourist. You cannot just sit down with the chief economist for the South African Reserve on a weekday and would you like to get a coffee?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those connections. Another one that was really, really fun was it was the CFO of Christian Louboutin when we were in Paris. And this guy, you know, this is like something that's also a bit about like the value of a Darden education was the buzzword is like the enterprise perspective. And we're like, oh, all right, he's the CFO, right? He's some number cruncher who's just going to kind of tell us, you know, a bit about the financials of how this company runs. And the guy was incredible, right? Like so fluent in all of the different parts of the business. I mean, he understands the creative, he understands the manufacturing, the operations, he understands the marketing, has really, really deep knowledge of the fashion industry, which was, you know, something that I've never come close to. So it was really super interesting, super, you know, just like thought provoking in the way that, you know, being able to see some of these common problems through his eyes kind of like opens up another, you know, you see these things in a different way. And it's like, oh, that's how, you know, this guy is one of the best in his business. That's how he's thinking about it. And so there's a lot of learning that happens just by, you know, being in the room with really smart people and getting to pick their brain and ask, you know, I think we had like a 2-hour Q&A with this guy about every different thing of, you know, where are you making your, you know, where's the workshop that's hand making these shoes to, you know, are you going to go in a digital versus retail? You know, like what is the future of your sales? Is it all digital? Is it retail space? You know, how do you stay fresh in the fashion industry? One of the things that he told us says in fashion, you're only ever 18 months away from being dead. And we're like, wow, like really? Like, isn't like, there are these big, you know, Prada, Chanel, like these huge brands. It's like, if you have right fashion, it's all about the fashion shows. If you have 3 bad seasons, right, your spring and then your fall and then your next spring, if you have 3 bad ones in a row, your company's done. And like hearing about like, that's how competitive it is. And that's how it is in the fashion world is you're only ever 18 months away from being on top to being all the way at the bottom, which kind of, you know, that speaks to why that particular industry is so tolerant of risk. I think in a way that when you talk to like a manufacturer or somebody else who does a very different kind of business, you know, they would say, you know, we're ever 18 months away from making a decision, you know, because that's just the way some of these things are. So it was really enlightening to have those opportunities with some of the speakers.
I'm still trying to process how like these famous fashion houses can essentially be like 18 months away from being out, from being from over. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, so you graduate from Darden. I think about your class of 2018, mm-hmm. right? So y'all were the pioneers in some way. So I'm sitting here at Sands Family Grounds, our base location in the DC area. Your class had the opportunity to be part of the first Roslyn section. There was a Roslyn section and a Charlottesville section in your class. Yeah. And so our DC area story as a school begins really with your class in that section. And that section started down the street. At 1919 North Lynn. I feel like it's my responsibility to keep up with these small details, Drew. I should just say. So started down the street.
Yeah,
at 1919 North Lynn, which is the Deloitte building. Here at the top of that building, Waterview Conference Center, which was then managed by the Corporate Executive Board. And here, and then you've actually finished classes here at Sands Family Grounds. The elective classes were actually here. This is kind of really great parallel aspect. Like you were part of the first group that had this as an option, but you also were the first group that had an opportunity to take class here in what is our home base here in the DC area. So
in April 2018, it wasn't probably as shiny as it is now. they're still putting in some of the fixtures, but yeah, it was cool to see that take place over, you know, the 2 years that we were there.
Absolutely. So you graduate from Darden and then what?
So graduated from Darden. And then, you know, I was still working at DKT and some of the work that I had been working on, right. We did like, I think I mentioned this, the nonprofit version of an acquisition. And so we're now like a medical device manufacturer. That's what we acquired was the licensing and the rights to manufacture this medical device. And so we had to set up a base somewhere, right? Like a hub to be the place where all this activity would take place. And so we were looking at a few different places, and because of the global nature of our business, we had to be in Europe somewhere just because the time zones are a lot easier. That's what my colleagues wanted. And we eventually settled on Paris. And so I moved to Paris, I guess we graduated in May. I moved to Paris in October 2018. And so we moved over there and it was great. I mean, it was a lot of fun being there. It was also, you know, a real live startup. When we started, there were three people in the office, me, my boss, and another person. And now we probably have 25 or 27 people in this business. And we've grown from doing a little over $3 million a year in revenues to about 20. And so a nice trajectory. And it's been a beautiful challenge in terms of, you know, we commercialize our product in about 115 countries around the world. And so we have kind of, we're piggybacking on the existing DKT international infrastructure, right? Those 65 countries about where we have our own kind of operations. But then we also sell this device in developed countries, in the United States, in Japan, in the UK, and across Europe. And we're working with more established specialty distributors, so medical device distributors. And so I've been doing a lot of that. And I was the marketing director for DKT Woman Care is the name of that subsidiary. And so we did that. And then we started acquiring, you know, we had this really broad distribution network, but we were kind of losing the opportunity. We were just selling one product. And so we saw the opportunity to put more of these other reproductive health products into this same distribution network and grow our business that way. And so some of what I've been doing over the past, boy, I guess 4 years now since graduating from Darden has been a lot of supplier negotiations, a lot of looking at what kinds of new technologies and products are coming out. Because the world of contraceptives and family planning products is a bit unique in that it's one of the only classes of pharmaceutical product where you're giving it to someone who's otherwise completely healthy, right? Most drugs you're giving to somebody to treat something. This one you're actually trying to prevent something from happening. And that has typically, the only other thing like that are vaccines. And vaccines have, at least in the United States, have a specific cutout for liability where the manufacturers don't bear as much liability. And the powers that be have never extended that to contraception. And so there's historically been a large underinvestment in contraceptives. And that's why, you know, the same technology that was uncovered in the 1960s, a lot of women are still using, you know, there's second, third, fourth generation pills, but they're all kind of basically the same. Those step changes, the changes are fairly small in the big picture. And so part of what my job has been doing is looking at what are the new products that are coming out? What's the, you know, what's that bridge of R&D from kind of looking at new products? And then what do we need for these new products to be able to reach feasibility on a global scale? Because typically in the product development life cycle for pharmaceutical products, at least, is you spend a bunch of money on clinical trials and stuff, and then you charge a really high price for the 10 years that you have patent protection so that you can recoup all your costs. And then generics enter and the prices come down, et cetera. But that's, you know, as a nonprofit organization, that's not really what we are interested in doing. And so what we're finding is that there are a number of researchers who are really motivated, who are really, you know, who very much desire to make these products to help women around the world. Just kind of out of their, you know, they're not all saints, but they're doing it out of the goodness, out of the belief in the mission. And for those people, there's often been a lack of opportunity to bring those products to market, right? They're researchers, they're PhD types, they're, you know, they don't necessarily know how to commercialize these products. And the typical pathway was you would sell that IP to a big pharma. And then the big pharma is really good at doing the clinical trials and kind of doing the rest of it. And so we're trying to fill this gap and offer some of the researchers who developed these life-changing products a different way of bringing these products to market because we have the scale, because we're working in developed and developing countries, we can both kind of, you know, have a foot in markets where you can make a return, where you can pay for all of the investment that you've made. But then you also get the scale in the developing world where you can start reaching the economies of scale quicker from the manufacturing side. And so we're trying to address, this is probably too much detail, but we're trying to address a pretty specific niche in the market that hasn't really existed yet. And I credit some of the education at Darden of helping me develop the frameworks to see these different opportunities because it's something that doesn't exist yet. You know, and that's, it's always harder to do something that doesn't exist rather than just copy in a business model that's already there. And so that's part of what my work has been doing. When I moved back to the United States, I changed roles from being the director of marketing to director of strategy and business development. So my hat is now more firmly in this camp of, how do we link these promising products to the women and the men who want to use them? Because that's where we can deliver the impact that we're looking for.
Well, true. I feel like I just learned so much about all sorts of things I did not know anything about, which is seemingly always the case when I talk to you. I'm curious, ask you a very pedestrian question by comparison to what you just shared. What's it like to pick up and move from the U.S. to Paris? I've never done that. I mean, I like moved from North Carolina to Virginia to DC. Like this is what I got. So
slowly creeping your way northward.
That's right. But what is that like? I mean, and obviously you're navigating, you speak French, and you probably have spent some time in Paris. You work for a French company, so the culture is not entirely unfamiliar. Language is not unfamiliar, but still some change.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the biggest kind of cultural change and maybe the easiest way to describe it with a short story. There's this guy, we were at like a WeWork basically. It was a Regus, like a co-working space. And there's this really nice guy at the front desk who would always help us. And he says bye, I'm not going to see you guys again. I was offered a manager job at another location. I said, oh, like, congratulations. That's wonderful. When you have a promotion opportunity, you got to take it. And my colleague standing next to me turns and she's like, no, you don't. And what was so, one of the big cultural lessons that we learned living in France is that, different to the United States, is that people truly don't work like for the sake of working. Like, working is just a means to enjoying your life. And, when I introduce myself to people here in the US, I'll often talk about my job. Whereas in France, it may be that you talk about I love to paint, or I'm really into music, right? Like, you talk about your hobbies, your interests, much more, right? That is where your identity is based, is much more in the things that you're interested in, or the passions that you have, as opposed to how you work or what you do for work. And that's, it's just a difference. It's not good or bad either way. If you're spending 8 hours at work a day, that's still a significant part of your time. But the French, like, the way that they treat work is very different than the way that we treat work. And, of course, there's all the jokes about like the 35-hour work week, which is true. That is, there's like, for managers, it's a little bit different, but for kind of the folks, my team, you have to manage a 35-hour work week. And like, when people go to lunch for a few days, I would like go out and buy a sandwich and eat a sandwich at my desk. And that is like anathema in France. Like, that is not done. And they would look at me kind of weird. They're like, why is he just eating at his desk like that? Because in France, it's very much the culture that you stop, you take an hour, everybody kind of goes to the kitchen or cafeteria, and you sit and you eat, and then you stay there for a full hour, just talking, laughing, telling stories, doing whatever it is. And that time together is very much an important part of the social fabric of any company, not just ours, but any company. And so there are little, little things like that you pick up along the way where you're like, huh, like, this is really different. There are discrete cultural differences. Of course, everybody still is using Instagram and people love like Marvel films and things like that, but there's like the, the commonalities, but there are these kinds of enduring quirks of culture, I would say, that really did mark themselves.
So you're back here in the US, you're in this strategy role now. Yes. And doing some really interesting things. What are you excited about in terms of what's ahead or what's to come over the next few months, the coming years? Like, what are you looking forward to?
Yeah. Pardon my French, but we're hell-bent on growth. I mean, that's like one of the big things that I'm looking at is how do we kind of maximize what we're doing? And I think historically in the United States and elsewhere, healthcare has always been very conservative. Right? Like, it's a very slow industry to adopt changes. And I think there was a guy in my class, Andy Shore, if you remember, who is a doctor. And he's like, how is it possible that I can buy an airplane to go around the world on my phone, but I can't schedule a doctor's appointment, right? And I think COVID has shown us, you know, one of the upsides of COVID has been a much greater appetite for what we call demedicalization. Like, how do we reduce the barriers to accessing healthcare? And that's something that we're seeing, you know, like telemedicine is something that's grown leaps and bounds over the past 3 years in a way that would have been unimaginable 5 years ago. And so I think in terms of what I'm doing in my work, like we're really trying to think about how can we make the process, the experience of accessing healthcare better, because for so many people, it's still a big pain, right? Like getting a prescription, being able to get that product, the pricing of that product, you know, how you're able to switch between these different products. And so, you know, because one of, I'll nerd out again for just a brief moment. Like in my industry, one of the big, like some of the statistics we look at are unmet need for contraception, right? So in a country, how many people want to use family planning but are not using it? And we track this number, and it's a percentage. And when we start asking why, a lot of women say like, oh, well, I was using something, but I didn't like it, right? Like I didn't like the side effects. I didn't like, you know, what it did to my body. I didn't, my husband didn't like me using it, something like that. And so that means that like, that's a product failure, right? It's a product or a service failure, right? That we haven't been able to meet this woman's need. She has the will, but doesn't have the right product to meet her need. And so I think, you know, it sounds a little dorky, but you know, I wake up in the morning thinking about how can I bridge that gap? How can we bring these products to the people who want to use them? How can we help them, you know, live their best life and live a pleasurable, free life, you know, being able to do all the things they want to do by, you know, getting these products to them. And so, of course, it's easier to, you can send a condom in the mail. It's not that complicated, but things, you know, like pills, controlled substances, pharmaceuticals, there's a lot more barriers to being able to do that. And so we're trying to think about how do we flatten that distribution chain where, you know, I work with a manufacturer on one side, and then I do all the steps in between to get that product to the consumer with as little trouble, costs, complexity as possible.
Did COVID change your work much? Did it impact what you were doing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a number of our, right, like for an IUD, for example, an intrauterine device is a common method of contraception. And that necessarily you have to go to a hospital or a clinic to have it inserted. And so, you know, we saw a lot of these kinds of products that require a doctor's intervention. There's just no, like women didn't want to go, right? People are delaying seeking care, or they just weren't getting them. And so there was a shift towards more of these like over-the-counter or products that you could get from a pharmacy or kind of a chemist or a chemical shop. Because of that, I think there was also, I mean, at the very beginning of COVID, there was just like supply chain ruptures everywhere. And we're still seeing huge upheaval in the shipping sector. China and India are the two big manufacturing hubs for pharmaceuticals, and sea and air freight from those countries are still extremely expensive. And when we're talking about the supply chains for, you know, for the countries that we're working in, you know, if your freight cost goes up by three times, like we don't have the margins to just swallow that, right? And so either we have to charge more for the consumer, or we need to try and find a donor who can help eat that cost until things normalize again. But we don't know when things will return to normal. So I think there were changes in both like consumer habits as well as provider habits. Some clinics, some hospitals just said, you know, don't, you know, we are dealing, everything is on COVID. If you're trying to come in for an IUD insertion, for example, just don't come in because we're not going to be able to see you. We don't have the space. We don't have the beds. So there were a lot of changes, you know, to our work in terms of both the end customers, the women who are looking, the men and women who are looking for these products, as well as to the providers, the intermediaries who deliver them.
Well, true. I feel like I could keep asking you questions for at least a couple more hours, but I'm not going to do that to you. I know you got a lot going on. We ask all of our guests the same last question. What would be a piece of advice or a couple pieces of advice you would share with a prospective student kind of thinking about this step, thinking about Darden, perhaps thinking about the executive MBA program? What would you share?
I mean, I think a good piece of advice that that Paul Simcoe shared, which was definitely true for me, is that at Darden, you get about a third of all the things you learn are like in the classroom and in the discussions. About a third of all the things you learn are kind of on your own, doing the readings and reflection. And then the last third is when you're kind of going through things with your learning team. I think that was something that really stuck with me, because it's intimidating, right? Like thinking about going to business school was intimidating. You know, when I first met the 120 people in my cohort, I think there were three of us who came from like an NGO nonprofit background. So I felt I was a fish out of water. There's like people who work at banks, or, you know, people who are accountants. There's a guy who works at the SEC, and I'm like, shit, I'm taking accounting classes with these people. I'm never going to be able to match up. But, you know, you rely on the different people around you to help you get through the program. And, that was definitely true outside of the confines of Darden as well. You know, I relied on my wife a lot. She gave me a lot of support. I had support from my employer, from my mentors at work, who knew that I was doing this program, who were like very accepting. And so like, you have to embrace that, right? You to go through the program, if you want to get the most out of it, you need to have that kind of support network to help you manage it. And I think that's the second point, is that at Darden, for me at least, you get out of it what you put into it. And so they're very much, you know, there's a parallel universe somewhere where I just like skimmed all the readings and did the very minimum to get by. But that's a universe where I didn't learn nearly as much as I did in this one. And so, you know, you can, and that's, maybe I shouldn't say this, but that's everyone's choice, right? You can kind of pick your poison and do what you want to do, but, you know, it's an expensive and time consuming decision. And hopefully, you know, for a lot of people, getting an MBA is probably the last formal education they'll have. And so I wanted to make the most of it. And I think that, you know, by taking the time to really engage with the material, to think about it critically, seriously, and to give, you know, you give it, it's like having a healthy respect for the program and for the decision to embark on this program. By doing that, I was able to get a ton out of it. And really, you know, when I think about what I learned, it's indescribable. You know, I can't put into simple words all the different lessons that I've taken out of the program and how they help me in my personal life, how they help me in my work life, how they help me, you know, in the hobbies and everything else that makes up who I am. So I think, you know, if you want to get the most out of it, go for it, and then rely on the people around you.
Well, True, such a pleasure catching up with you. And we're so thrilled to hear all the exciting things that are happening for you. Glad to hear you're back in the area. Just a hop, skip, and a jump away over there in Annapolis.
I was fortunate. There were two other EMBAs in my class in Europe. Corbin was in the Netherlands, and then Aben is in London. So I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only flag on the European side.
Yeah, Corbin. Where in the world is Corbin Norman? That's what I always wonder. We saw him. He was gracious enough to come back, and he's participated in a missions event. And I actually saw him in person. I couldn't believe it. He was back home for a bunch of personal stuff, weddings, etc. And he came through the DC area. You know, he's in the Netherlands now, I think, doing big things. It's great. This is like one of the highlights of my job. Not just the people that you get to meet along the way, but then you get to see what they go on and do. So thrilled for you. So happy for your family. And thank you so much for taking time out of your day, your afternoon, to share your story with our listeners.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for inviting me. And it was a pleasure. And, you know, I hope you get a bunch of listens and people who are excited about the program.
And that was my interview with True Overholt, a graduate from our Executive MBA class of 2018. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's EXEC, MBA at darden.virginia.edu. Until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.